ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's alliance with the United States has been the linchpin of our country's foreign policy for decades.
We value the unbroken friendship between the Australian and the American peoples.
But between the wars and the tariffs and the unpredictability, are we growing apart?
You know who else didn't help us? Australia.
Join me, Hamish McDonald.
And me, Geraldine Doogas. We ask, do we still need the alliance? Search for Global Roaming on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's a conundrum that we're going to be opening up on today's health report. And it's the resistance that some people have that problems that are all too real can be just in your head.
Mm.
Not imaginary, but just in your head.
I feel the health profession often doesn't explain this well to patients.
Yeah.
I think we're part of the problem here. And so I'm very careful with patients to say, your pain is very real, but the brain's perception of it and other factors are a huge part of it too. But the pain is real.
And other symptoms are too. And we're going to be talking today on the Health Report about a condition called fibromyalgia, where there's a lot of pain, a lot of fatigue, a lot of other symptoms as well. And people with fibromyalgia often feel neglected, misunderstood, and they feel that they're led to believe that it doesn't exist.
That's coming up on today's Health Report. I'm Priya Alexander on Wurundjeri Land.
And I'm Norman Swan, also on Wurundjeri Land. Nice
same
to be
room.
On Wurundjeri Land for a change.
Yeah.
Also on the show,
iron infusions in women of reproductive age in Australia. The rates are skyrocketing. The question is that good or bad?
And for the first time in a long time, we're going to be covering HIV/AIDS on the Health Report. Years ago, when in fact the Health Report started, we did a lot on HIV/AIDS. And I did an interview the other day, which reminded me, sadly, that in some parts of the world, we're not moving that quickly.
Mm.
There was a lot of déjà vu. I'm not doing this interview to depress you. It's just that there is a challenge, particularly since Elon Musk has run the vacuum cleaner through the major US aid organisation. So in news this week, interesting results from an Australian study of respiratory syncytial virus, RSV virus vaccines in pregnant women.
So this has been published in JAMA Pediatrics, and it's looked at the effectiveness of that vaccine that we're offering to all pregnant women from 28 weeks of pregnancy.
And it's, just to explain, it's partly to protect the women, but largely to protect the babies in the first few months of life when they don't have their own antibodies.
It's like the whooping cough vaccine. I say to patients all the time, Norman, that it's about the antibodies going across the placenta to the baby. So when they come out of the womb, they have some protection, a seatbelt on.
And this study was designed to look for severe disease, babies that were hospitalised with respiratory tract infections, largely that went down into their lungs, lower respiratory tract infections, namely pneumonia, to see how babies with respiratory syncytial virus compared to babies without respiratory syncytial virus, and what was the role of vaccine in the RSV babies.
And the takeaway is really that in the infants who had RSV, where the mother had been vaccinated in pregnancy, there was significant benefit. So there was a 78 to 81% reduction in RSV-associated hospital admissions in the babies whose mothers had been immunised. So fairly significant.
And it's a bit like, say, influenza vaccination, where it doesn't necessarily prevent the infection itself, but it prevents the serious complications.
You can get it from 28 weeks of pregnancy. The whooping cough vaccine we tend to do from 20 to 32 weeks of pregnancy. So most of my patients will come in at 30 weeks and go, Priya, can I please have RSV and whooping cough? They're protected against both and they're in the window for both.
I've had a conversation about this before. They should be asking for influenza vaccine as well.
Yeah, they're usually done with that. They've already had that, Norman.
They've already had
that. Yeah, I'm all over that.
We're
all over it. Yeah, correct. But this just shows how effective the vaccination is. And there's, of course, that other monoclonal antibody for babies who are born whose mothers were not vaccinated in pregnancy or for babies who are already still higher risk.
And that simulates the immune response if they'd had a vaccine and in terms of the antibodies. And then there's this story which really circulated widely in the news during the week, which we're going to just take apart a little bit.
Are.
So here's the theme, just to set the theme, is the medical system kind of gives up on you when you turn 70.
Oh, do you think so? so?
Yeah, I think so. I
mean,
I've got a way to go yet, but you know, cancer screening stops, for example, in your 70s.
You stop being recruited, but many GPs will continue after discussion with the patient. I have to say, deprescribing is actually a part of care. Look, you can see my hackles have gone up.
Yeah, yeah. I've really got to that vulnerable point.
the GP in me. Oh, you know.
How dare
there
you
are many
say that.
Failings across the system, but yes.
But there is some scepticism as to whether or not, you know, you should be on cholesterol-lowering drugs, blood pressure-lowering drugs. And we've done a lot of stories on this in the Health Report in the past that to show that, in fact, if you've got high blood pressure, if you're over 70, it should be treated, and it should be treated to get it really back to normal levels. You shouldn't be lily-livered about it. You should get going and doing it.
If tolerated. Because you can increase the risk of falls, Norman, then a hip fracture and a subdural hematoma. There is risk and benefit. This is my everyday.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I stand corrected.
There's nuance.
But the point being, and also cholesterol reduction, you know, as part of, you know, if you've had, say, stents, or you've had a heart attack, or you've had angina, what's called secondary prevention, trying to prevent another one, effective. Research at the George Institute and elsewhere has shown both for blood pressure and cholesterol, worth doing.
Secondary prevention all the way.
The controversy, and the words and the phrase primary prevention is going to come up later on in the program in the context of HIV, but in this case we're talking about it in relation to coronary heart disease. Primary prevention, you're otherwise healthy. Does an intervention prevent the disease in the first place? So this was a study of several thousand people getting cholesterol medications randomized. And these were not people who were at high risk of heart disease.
No, they're community-dwelling, well, 70-year-olds with fairly normal cholesterols.
And in fact, with no history of coronary heart disease. So they're free of coronary heart disease. And the question was, over the next 6 years, what happened to them?
So some of them got a statin, atorvastatin 40. Some of them got nothing. And I think, please, before we really drill this out.
Which is, by the way, quite a high dose of
atorvastatin. Yes, of atorvastatin it is. The headlines I saw this week were statins in over 70s reduces risk of heart attack and stroke by 30%. That was the kind of headlines that I was seeing. Did you see them?
I did.
It's a little bit more nuanced than that.
So the first thing that you need to do when you're a consumer looking at headlines is that when somebody says something reduces by 30%, you have to say, well, that sounds dramatic.
Yeah.
But what is the actual reduction? And if your risk of a heart attack was low and it goes down by 30%, it's only going down by a little bit. So, you know, drug companies love to use what's called relative risk reduction rather than absolute risk reduction. So first of all, it's a fairly dramatic headline. But true, they did reduce heart attacks and strokes, but did it matter to the individual?
And that's the key thing. So they've looked at several different endpoints here. So they've looked at cardiovascular events, they've looked at stroke, and then they've added this other endpoint of coronary revascularization, which
so this is a stent,
yes,
basically.
Putting something in to open up the coronary artery. Actually, when you look at it in the groups who are on statins and not on statins, the statins didn't reduce your risk of dying in a statistically significant way and didn't reduce your risk of long-term disability-free survival. Really where the outcome was seen that all these headlines have focused on is in this coronary revascularization group, which we should be clear is very cardiologist-dependent. They're more likely to go and intervene on people with a high cholesterol. There's a lot of nuance and grey there.
And in fact, if you've got stable angina, it doesn't improve your outcome unless it's in one particular artery called your left main. If it's not in the left main, then treating medically to get your cholesterol down, your blood pressure down, and your other risk factors, is what helps.
Mm. But you get symptomatic improvement. You might get less symptoms if you have the stent in. But I think the long and the short of this is, am I putting every patient now over 70 on a statin because of this study? Because that's what the headlines have suggested. It is.
Which is what the drug companies would love to happen.
Yes, possibly, because they'll earn a lot more money than they already are, although they're earning enough, I would argue. But it's a lot more nuanced. There's a lot of discussion about deprescribing. in patients as they age to improve quality of life, take stuff out of the Webster pack, reduce the risk of side effects, adverse effects. So it's not that clear cut. It's nuanced. You have to chat to your health professional. But actually, Norman, the number needed to treat in this was 37.
Meaning 37 people have got to be treated for one stent to be prevented.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have to admit that there were reductions in heart attacks and strokes as part of this study. And the question is just how meaningful that is. So the question is really, if you're over 70, cholesterol's normal, you've got no history of coronary heart disease, should you go on a statin?
Mm.
And that's a discussion, as you say, to have with your GP. But, you know, GPs are trained to do something called your absolute risk score.
Yes, and we have a calculator for that.
Where age, admittedly, is the strongest risk factor by the time you get to over 70.
There are these scores, there's all this stuff, Norman, but at the end of the day, it comes down to the patient in front of you, and everyone has different seesaw risk benefit pros and cons. And I might have two 73-year-old patients, and one will choose the statin and one won't, and they're both okay. They're both fine decisions. It's up to the patient, it's shared decision making.
And if you want to educate yourself further on this, we'll have a link to that paper on our website. So now our WTF section, you know, we love our WTF section. And if you don't know what WTF it means, just ask your 14-year-old at home. So our WTF section is, you know, really surprising or shocking things that are going on. This week, we have to do a bit of a correction.
Or a discussion.
Or a clarification.
It's up for debate.
So last week's WTF, for I unleash you, is that we said that there were two measles deaths in amidst a fairly significant measles epidemic and outbreak in the United States. They were in Pennsylvania, in Lancaster County. The newspaper report suggested one was an infant. And the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control in the United States, still hasn't put them down as measles deaths.
They've refused to.
And the allegation is that the Democratic governor, Shapiro of Pennsylvania, jumped the gun and they may not have been measles deaths. And we're going now on newspaper reporting, not on the stats that should be coming out of CDC.
There's a bit more in it though, I think, because the British Medical Journal have published a news piece on this, which we will link in the show notes. There's some debate and discussion as to this term measles associated death, the infant in question.
So dying with measles rather than of measles.
Yes. And from what I understand from this BMJ article, this is what the reference that I'm using, the infant that died, the mother had tested positive for measles, the infant did as well, and the infant sustained a splenic rupture.
So just to explain, the spleen is an organ on the left side of your upper abdomen, and rupture is not a good thing to occur because you die of hemorrhage unless it's controlled very quickly, recognised and controlled very quickly.
So the British Medical Journal article says that the family physician and Republican elected coroner, it's very specifically that political element is in there, added that the infant's immediate cause of death was a ruptured spleen, but that they couldn't say that it was definitely due to the underlying measles. Now, there's a lot of debate and discourse here between many authorities saying, well, it's most likely the measles that has caused the splenic rupture in an infant, which is quite rare. I would say it's very nuanced now and political.
So the main reason we're talking about it is we're very definite about it last week. We're a little bit less definite about it this week, but it's really sad, WTF, that politics gets in the way of vaccination
and health
epidemiology.
Agree. On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report.